All the services are going to stop. So your garbage collection, you're going to have transportation systems shutting down because people don't work for free. And so it is really going to be a very difficult thing to be living in a city. And of course, we're probably going to have energy problems and you name it.
Adapt 2030 Mini Ice Age Conversations covers changes in our climate due to a new and intensifying grand solar minimum. In the media, overlooking, downplaying, or burying cold weather changes occurring on our planet. This is in order to keep the global warming agenda steaming full speed ahead. I do this podcast and radio program because we need to begin conversations on how to adapt our food growing strategies long before 2030 as agricultural zones shift, affecting global crop output. But very few mainstream media outlets are talking about the most important issue of our time, cold weather crop losses. Our sun is going through a 400-year cycle, which has effects on our weather patterns as our magnetosphere weakens and the jet streams go out of flow. It's not CO2, it's not you, it's the sun. Are you ready to thrive in the grand solar minimum? Then join me for Mini Ice Age Conversations. I'm your host, David Dubine. Today I have with me Peter Temple, futurist, market analyst, talking about cycles. And when I mean cycles, truly, the science of prediction through cycles. And when we talk about cycles, most people are talking about decadal cycles or multi-century cycles. Let's talk about solar cycles, business cycles, market cycles, economic cycles, and how the climate ties all of this in together with the ebbs and flows of our economy, human civilization, the apex of our science, and the decline into the dark ages. It's all overlapping into these cycles.
If you can just go back about 2 minutes when you're talking about the effects of government, and I was talking about the fast track down into the dark ages. If they're going to take away our power, we're truly at the mercy of nature. And when I say that, I'm talking about literally going back to the settler days and more of this pioneering lifestyle. If we don't have electricity for our lives, especially during these cold winters, where's that going to leave us as a society or even in a city fashion or province or state? It's just ridiculous.
Well, it is ridiculous, but that's certainly what's going to happen. I am toying with the idea of getting a fairly good-sized generator because I'm concerned about that, certainly because I have an internet business that I am running. That's the other fear is that we're going to start to lose some of the internet infrastructure, and that's going to make communication very difficult. So I don't know how bad it's going to get, but it could get pretty bad. But you're right, energy is going to be a really big problem.
The loss of power on our planet, this is going to kill millions of people especially during this cold time. And you know that's on their heads for taking away our power. You can't leave somebody without power, especially knowing what's coming up in this colder time, especially in the Northern Hemisphere. I mean, just how many people live in cold climates that rely on heating every single winter? What if they can't get that heating?
We do. I'm in Canada here. I mean, you were talking about that up above the 45 degree level. Yeah, we really need it because I'll tell you, it's really cold. We've already had a little bit of snow. This is like mid-September. We've had a good week of temperatures in single degrees Celsius, which is very unusual for us for September. But I've been warning people about this and that it's going to start to get a lot colder. So we're already seeing this happen. I think we're going to have, as you said, the coldest winter we've had in many, many years. And this is going to obviously continue. But the thing that, you know, really concerns me is the government's ability, our political system, and the government's ability to propagandize all of the information that goes out there. So people think that everything is just fine. And of course, the governments, as you sort of alluded to, can't really tell us the truth, because if they told us the truth, they're not going to get elected. They get elected based on the economy and how people are feeling. So they will do everything they can to prop this thing up for as long as they can, which makes the crash even worse when it happens, because Mother Nature eventually takes over. Man cannot control the economy. They can do it for a little while. They can put us into as much debt as we are in right now, but there is a point where everybody loses confidence in government's ability to pay them back, and that's where you start to have the wonkiness that we have now. And I'm looking at the stock market that I'm in every day and saying, okay, I think we got 4 or 5 weeks before this thing turns, and yet the bulk of the population thinks everything is just fine.
Yeah, and that goes in with the whole media blitz right now. They're trying to explain it, saying CO2 causes all the snow and the ice and the cold conditions you're seeing. Because, see, when you and I were growing up, it was all about CO2 is going to create a warming environment. We're going to boil slowly like frogs in a pot. And now they're saying, oh, CO2 is causing all this anomalous snow and cold weather and increasing ice that you're seeing across Greenland and the Arctic. Oh, it's because of CO2. And again, this whole media narrative, if they're trying to control the media, just like they're saying now, oh, it's great harvest. Don't worry. There's nothing been lost. I mean, did they see what happened in Kansas with the blizzard that went across there and wiped out a majority of those crops? And what came back up was damaged, literally damaged plant material and those heads. They're not going to produce anything near the protein content that they needed to for spring wheat and winter both. And then we see the wipe out of the crops over in France from too wet and Germany, and it just again and again and again. And they're still talking rosy forecasts in the futures market, and somebody's controlling that behind the scenes, because the paper trade's trying to drive the prices super low right now. In reality, the losses you actually see occurring through the weather reports, they're like at 180 degrees opposites of each other.
Well, yeah, let me just talk about this cycle turn, that we're at the top of this cycle of very high temperature in terms of our climate, and then it's going to turn getting colder. Well, what Wheeler found out, Dr. Wheeler, who I've talked about before, in the 1940s, he went back through centuries and centuries, and each of these cycle terms, of course, you get extreme climate. So it is like right now, it's like going from summer to fall, or from winter to spring. You always get a lot of rainfall. The weather gets to be very extreme for a number of weeks as you have that turn. And so we have that sort of thing happening as we're going from a very warm climate right now to a very cold climate. And if you look at the temperature, as I'm sure you've probably told people, it's gone sideways for the last 18, 19 years since 1998. And that is a temperature top. So what we're getting, of course, is very extreme weather that gives us an indication that we are having a turn in the climate, and it's going to get very cold.
And again, that's something that they don't really want to touch on or try to admit or even kind of bring into the whole debate. Why did the temperature stall when we were told it would continue to increase, and they had all these prophecies going out for 2C warming, and it stalled? Okay, I agree that there was the El Nino that bumped temperatures, but then they fell off just as quickly and were right back down in that same range a year later. But that's not something that is open for debate. If you try to even talk about that, you'll be shut down at a public meeting. You try to talk about how the sun drives the climate, and then there's a relationship of cosmic rays to more cloud cover, and also the relationship of more volcanic eruptions and aerosols and different kind of particulates in the air that also cause more clouds with the albedo effect. You start talking about this in the public venues, and they shut you down right away. And I think the discourse needs to start right now, and this starts to – we really need to have an honest debate about why the temperature stalled, prior cycles that you're so into and I'm so into, and then where we're moving forward with, because none of the CO2 stuff has panned out so far, and there's another whole set of variables going on that are much more as the roadmap moving forward, and we really, really need to take a look at this.
And of course, the education system, which you're starting to really allude to, is also something that gets weaker as the cycle goes up. It was really interesting for me when I read a lot of Wheeler's work, and he talked about the cycle tops, and he said that grammar really becomes a big problem. You have terrible grammar at the top of these cycle tops, and I see that absolutely everywhere. I taught grammar across Canada for 3 years, and I'm just seeing that it's just an example of how the educational system is breaking down. And we see that with scores that are coming out of a lot of schools all over the U.S. and Canada, and you're even seeing it in Europe, that the educational system has really fallen apart. And it really comes down again to money, because we've got 4 cent dollars. So how can you support an educational system if your money is getting to be almost worthless? You can't do it. And so, you know, we suffer that way as inflation takes hold and gets, and our money gets debased to such an extent that it's valueless. And so this is just one of the other indicators of a cycle turn and going into deflation. And all of this stuff works together. I just see it. I'm so sensitized to it that I see it through all aspects of society.
Yeah, and the business cycles following these climatic cycles as well, when we come down into, so what's going to happen when literally the harvests go below what we can actually, let me rephrase that. What happens when the harvests that are coming out of the fields aren't enough to supply everybody on this planet in the current paradigm that we exist in, where there's enough to put, where the throughput for a factory to make a good to put it into the supermarket, when you can go down and there's always any type of food that you can get, generally in the West in supermarkets, there's no food shortages here. Venezuela is an extreme case. Other places across the planet, you know, there's limited goods. There's not such the huge selection that we would see at all these hyper stores, you know, across the Western, more developed economy nations. But what happens at that point, and you've seen it again and again in history, when a society cannot produce enough food to keep itself running, and you go into this deficit year upon year, and then what happens from there?
And you're going to see guns come out. You're going to see people fighting for the food that's available. You're going to see a major revolution. You certainly don't want to be living in large cities. I'll tell you that much. You want to be outside a city, because the riots are going to go on, and it's going to be get very, very dangerous. Because if people don't have enough food, a large number of them will make sure that they do one way or the other.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, we've talked about that several times before, and just discussions I've had with people about this resurgence that people almost intuitively feel it, because out here in Asia, the biggest thing is, okay, you come into the city, you work, and you immediately go back out, and everybody wants to start an organic farm and get out of the city. And everybody's returning back, and they really want to leave this lifestyle and get out back to their hometowns and get somewhere. But the economies aren't so good, so they're developing. They're actually creating their own economies out of these villages and towns now that actually become these eco-centers and ecosystems on the weekends of, you know, burgeoning economies out in the countryside, where I could see that, you know, transition going. Let's say that, I don't know, Atlanta, Georgia, you know, not New York City or not L.A. or something. Houston, Texas. I mean, some of these, you know, second-tier, huge, large towns or whatever in the United States, I'll use for an example. And you could maybe, you could pick one up in Canada. Where would you choose? Where are they all going to go to? What if Atlanta empties out and you have 7 million people leave out of there? Where are they going to go back to? There's no hometowns as such that there is over here in Asia.
Well, Canada is not as much, and we have an awful lot of land, of course, and there's nobody up here comparatively to the U.S. But when you're living in a big city, Toronto would probably be the one that pops up to me. Vancouver, not as much, but Toronto for sure.
Okay.
It's going to be a very difficult place to live, and there really is nowhere else to go outside that. You've got country, but it's pretty well populated in that area, whereas out in Western Canada, not so much.
Yeah, and when people do come back to the, and we all see the writing on the wall that people are going to migrate out of the cities when they get back to their maybe traditional hometowns or maybe cities they grew up in, smaller towns. I mean, America, for at least, it was built on hometowns, and this big, huge cities sort of evolved in the last 50 years. But prior to that, as everywhere in the world, it was always, you know, smaller towns, if you will. So what kind of economies could you expect to develop as people go back into these more rural or, shall we say, smaller habitation areas?
Let me just point out one thing, just as we talk about cities as opposed to countries. You know, we have Ontario is our major province, our largest province in Canada. It's also the most in-debt sub-state in the world. In other words, it's a province that has more debt comparatively than any other sub-state anywhere. You can take California, and Ontario has twice the amount of debt. So when it goes bankrupt, and it will, it'll be their first province to go bankrupt, all the services are going to stop. So your garbage collection, you're going to have transportation systems shutting down because people don't work for free. And so it is really going to be a very difficult thing to be living in a city. And, of course, we're probably going to have energy problems and you name it. So this is one of the reasons why you get these migrations out to the country. And it's, in a lot of cases, a much better place to be, because if you learn how to, as they're doing in the U.S., I mean, there are people who are already cropping up stories of people raising chickens and pissing off their neighbors because they're doing that. But, I mean, this is where the economy is going to go. This is what happened in the 1930s. You need to start yourself a garden. You need to understand where your food is. I always tell people, I'm fortunate in that I live in a place where I can actually walk to fresh water, and that should certainly be a concern, because you can't live without water, and there's going to be an awful lot of other people wanting the same water that you have. For example, if I was living in New York City, which is surrounded pretty well, by seawater, what are you going to do in places like Hawaii, for example, which is totally, I mean, they do have some running water internally, obviously, but when transportation starts to break down, what are you going to do in some of these large cities when you can't get to water very easily and the store shelves are completely empty? That's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I lived in Maui for several years, and just the amount of food that could be grown on the island at that point, they had to import almost 99% of what was consumed every day. I understand there's a large tourist industry and everything going on, but still, even if there was no tourists that ever came to the island, the couple hundred thousand people living on Maui, that island couldn't grow enough food to support those 200,000 people there. You know, so if you even get into that sort of talking about how many people could an island in Hawaii sustain by self-growing all the meat and the food or the fish or whatever it might be, the vegetables that are coming out of there, you'd have to, A, redo everything way into more of a localized economy, and then how many people could that truly support? Not 200,000, 300,000. That's why the islands never got that populated back in the day. I mean, even when the ships sailed up there, they only found, you know, you didn't find 8 million people or 2 million people living in Oahu. That just didn't happen. I mean, those islands couldn't support that much. And also, talking about the debt, and you said go ahead and get in cash, and I also agree, cash and also maybe some coins, because I know those can be traded. But think about how many people are in debt, and how many people are riding credit card debt to credit card debt, paying off, swapping cards. What happens when they really need cash and their credit system shuts off? Now, that's another whole wild card people aren't talking about either, because there's so many people that have brought up into this credit system that are so deeply in debt. They're $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 on credit card debt, and they got zero cash. So when you really need cash to go to the bank and they cut off those cards, then what's going to happen?
Exactly. So longer term, you don't need to get into silver and gold, and if you do want to buy some of that, make sure you get coins, because it's not something you're trying to keep around for wealth reasons. It's things you want to have that as elements that you can use to buy things, to trade with people, that sort of thing. So it needs to be in small coins. People sometimes get these gold bars. Well, unless you're going to melt them down into coins, they're just not practical for actually buying things. So you want to do that. But you certainly want to be in the short term. Let me just add to that, because so that people understand, deflation is the value of your currency actually goes up in deflation. So currency becomes a lot more valuable. All the prices of assets go down. So you will find that buying a car, cars, they won't be able to give them away. In fact, it's getting tough for them to give them away now. But certainly houses are going to go down to 20% of their value. And that is not because they're actually going down to 20% of their value. It's because the dollar or currency is going up 4 or 5 times in its value, and therefore the assets around it go up. It's the same, it's the reverse of what happens in inflation. As your money becomes worth less, of course, everything around it, houses and everything, go up in value, because people don't want to get paid in 4 cent dollars unless they can get a whole bunch of 4 cent dollars. And so housing prices and things go up. So it's the reverse in deflation. And when your currency goes up, gold and silver go down. So we're actually going to have a period of 4 to 5 years where gold and silver are going to be worth less, and I can see that in the work that I do that becomes very obvious over the next 4 or 5 years. And then eventually the financial system is going to collapse and gold and silver will become more valuable and they will be the way that you get what you need to get in life. And so I would say start planning on trying to get your hands on some silver and gold coins, but we're talking about probably 5 or 6 years from now as to when they will become critical that you own them.
Yeah, and by that point, too, you know, all the research I do points into population decline significantly by that point. 2023, yeah. 2024 will be the bottom of the cooling cycle anyway until we get this brief respite and then the canceling waves in the hemispheres on the sun go back in and then we have another, you know, 8-year period of cold and then we finally come out of it in the 2030s, 2035, or something like that. That's why I named my channel Adapt 2030, because we need to get to that point through 2030 to get through the full cycle and then come back out on the other side. So when we get to this cooling bottom, that's where I start to see the repeating history. When you're talking about the 1400s, 1600s, I mean, look what happened in the Black Death back then. Look what happened in Europe. There was nobody in the United States. I mean, the Native American Indians, but you saw what happened when even the very first people landed, Mayflower, they landed over there. Okay, they landed in the middle of a grand solar minimum. The Native American Indians were struggling to stay alive during this time. And if the best people on the planet and the most intuitive and the most in tune with their survival and their surroundings, if they were struggling to stay alive and we can't even grow food today, what chances does that give us? So, I mean, these northern climate latitude bands of where we rely on just-in-time delivery, and if you can't grow your own food and you don't know how to store it properly, there's going to be definite population decline on the planet. And then, you know, what's going to be the store of value? There'll be just less people around. So I see this balancing act going on between store of value, which is basically confidence. We get into the traditional mediums of silver, gold, maybe tools, or, you know, something that could be food will definitely be a tradable value. But again, if the ecosystem and the internet stays up, I truly believe that cryptocurrency will have some play in there as well. You know, you and I differ greatly on the crypto space moving forward. I believe it's the replacement for the evaporating system. But that's, you know, we could butt heads all day on that contentious issue right there.
Well, the tools that I use to trade, which is Elliott Wave and how the markets move, tell me that the crypto is a short-term thing, and they're never wrong. So we'll do a little side bet on that and see who wins on that one. But I think as everything collapses, you're just going to see, because, well, I just think as everything collapses, that's what I'm seeing from a number of different indicators, and the most valuable to me is the Elliott Wave principle and how the market moves, and that just tells me that Bitcoin and the other cryptos have pretty well all topped now or are in the process of topping.
Yeah, so go back into that again, because Fibonacci and sacred geometry and the different ways and just mathematics that our universe is set about anyway, there's base laws that adhere throughout all time, space, structure. I don't care if you go to another star system, that mathematical way that the universe is set, those rules apply everywhere. So when you're talking about the Elliott Wave and the Fibonacci retracements and trading or whatever, can you talk a little more about the Elliott Wave and how you see that moving forward and how you can see these cycles topping and declining?
Sure. And what I might provide for you, if you like, is I have an interesting little chart which shows the trend, because these trends, when you're in the stock market, you get trends and you get counter trends. So when a trend moves, it moves in five waves and it moves for quite a distance. And then you get a counter trend, which corrects for a while and then it picks up the trend again. And it does it in five waves. Well, it's interesting. You can see any trend throughout society will have five waves, just like you will see in the stock market. I have a very interesting chart, which I can provide you with, which is smoking. And it shows how smoking, people smoked and the actual trend went up in five very clear waves, and then at the very top it turned down and it started down in three waves, and I think it's going to eventually drop off, probably not totally, but you can see how the trend actually works in society as well. So this is Fibonacci based, and you see it all through the stock market. So it's interesting that people like Steve Pitts, who I mentioned to you, had done the statistics on the on cycles and sort of proved the probability of them at certain points, came out of trading. Most of the people, for example, Elliot, who came up with the principle and learned about the market, was a trader for a very long time. Some of the other people that have understood cycles came out of trading. Edward Dewey, who created the Foundation for the Study of Cycles, which I was an executive director for a while, that lasted for a very long time, from about 1941 when it was founded. And he put together a whole bunch of information on cycles and found that there were over 3,000 of them in business. All of these people came out of trading and started to understand the value of understanding cycles, and that they went all through society because they're all through the market. And so you can predict the market, and I do this every day from my site, and you can see some of the work that I do at worldcyclesinstitute.com. If you go to the market reports that are within my site, you can see how the patterns just repeat and repeat and repeat. So it becomes very predictable. Now, a lot of people, I get a lot of trolls that come by my site and tell me I'm absolutely, that's okay, because there's an awful lot of people making money based on my prediction, and they're the people that are in my subscription service. So these cycles go within the stock market. They are relentless. They repeat over and over. They have certain lengths that you can measure based on the golden mean and Fibonacci ratios. And this is all through society. So you can go through plants, for example, and the way that they grow. You can find Fibonacci ratios within that. You can find it in our DNA. You can find it in the measurements of our bodies. It is in absolutely everything throughout nature. And this comes from the planets, because, of course, if you were to measure the distance of the planets, they all have Fibonacci ratios, the golden mean ratio. They all average out to 0.618 or 1.618, which is the golden mean. And the distance of them is that ratio. So therefore, they have an influence on the Earth, and they create these changes within nature, within the Earth, and the way people think. I really believe that we're affected by electromagnetic waves, influenced by it, because the market moves based on Fibonacci ratios. And where do they come from? They come from the planets. It's like, duh. You know, eventually you kind of look and you realize that we are really impacted by nature to an extent that most people absolutely don't recognize or understand.
Yeah, that's true. And when you start talking about numerology, I mean, you just mentioned 1.618. Now, let's just do a little mind experiment here. If you add 1 plus 6 plus 1 plus 8, and then you get 16, and then you add 1 plus 6, that equals 7. Or we could do it the other way. We could take 16 plus 18, and then you get 34. And what's 3 plus 4? 7. So you start to see the repeating cycles. And also, with the 11.5-year solar cycle, when you start doing the same thing, multiplying up, everything adds up to 9. And you can keep going indefinitely, up to infinity. And everything you break down in the cycles off 11.5 years on how many you're multiplying out to get the grand solar minimum cycle, using 206, or you can use as many cycles or multicentral, it all adds up again to 9. Every time you break it down, it adds up to 9 when you do that same thing. So numerology, I like the concept of, there's a mathematical formula that the consciousness of existence abides by. And there is an intelligent consciousness behind the design of everything that is. And it's a mathematical numerical equation in the consciousness of thought that exists in time space, I guess. Maybe I'm going too deep on that, but
yeah, you are. But I find it very interesting just listening to you talk about it, and something I'm going to have to do a little bit of research on. That's interesting. I haven't spent a lot of time in numerology, but just hearing you describe it makes it very interesting, and I'm going to have to do a little bit of work. I do so much time, I spend so much time doing research in cycles, so sometimes getting out into these, going off on these tangents that relate, I don't get the time to do that, but that sounds very interesting to me, and I think I'll do a little bit of work on numerology.